go to Genesis chapter 32. We have been in a sermon series going through the book of Genesis. This is message number 33, entitled Limping Home. And from time to time, I have to give clarifications. That is the title of the sermon, not the title of my memoir of ministry travels. So, title of the sermon, Limping Home. So we're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 32, and we'll start with reading verses 1 and 2. And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's host." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. So the Apostle Paul was a prisoner in Caesarea, and he had been charged with very serious crimes against the Roman Empire when he appealed to Caesar himself. Now, this was his right as a freeborn Roman citizen, and it meant that he would have to be transferred over 2,000 miles away to Rome to appear before Caesar. Now, they had managed with some difficulty in making the transfer to make it to a port called the Fair Havens, and this was on the southern shore of the island of Crete. They needed to find a ship that was going to Italy. And so much time had passed that by the time that they found a ship, it was actually quite dangerous for them to set sail. And Paul warned them that it would be with much damage and loss if they attempted, if they put out from Crete and attempted to sail. Well, the plan that they had come up with, the soldiers such that were in charge of Paul and the other prisoners that they were transferring to Rome, the plan that they had come up with was to sail around Crete to a better port where they could spend the winter in, and then from there they could loose and go to finish the voyage to Italy. So they set out under a favorable wind, even though, again, by the time of the year it was dangerous for them to go. But they had a favorable wind, and they set out from Crete. But that wind quickly turned unfavorable and drove them away from the island of Crete and away from their plan. So after days in this terrible storm, the many difficulties that they had faced, Paul sought to encourage them. And he told them how that an angel had appeared to him and had assured him that there would be no loss of life among all who remained in the ship, but that the ship was going to be wrecked and be a total loss. Well, they ended up running aground off the island of Malta that we know today as Malta, and the ship was broken up. And so they had to abandon ship, and they had to get to shore essentially any way they could. Now, some of the soldiers wanted to just go ahead and kill the prisoners and just consider them a total loss along with the ship, and then save themselves. That was the plan they had come up with. But the centurion, the one who was in charge of the detail, forbid them from doing that because it says that he wanted to save Paul. And that's where we read here in Acts chapter 27, verses 43 to 44. But the centurion, willing to save Paul, kept them from their purpose, killing all the prisoners, and commanded that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get to the land. And this verse, in verse 44, it's just for some reason, it's always been a remarkable verse to me. And the rest, some on boards, some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to land. They had to abandon the ship, but they all made it to land, some able to swim, some clinging to boards or pieces of the ship that had broken up, whatever it was that they could find that was floating and make it into the shore, but they made it. But there was a lot of loss, and there was a lot of difficulty, there was a lot of hardship that was endured, but they made it. Well, the accounts of the apostles and the early churches go on like that. Suffering, persecution, trials, difficulties. Paul even said it at one time to a group that you're going to enter the kingdom of heaven through much tribulation. In Hebrews chapter 11, that we refer to many times as the great chapter of faith, or the hall of faith, or the heroes of faith, talks about all of these great victories that you might say that were achieved by faith. And then he says this in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 36 to 38. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And this continues. It continues throughout history and even down to today for the Lord's people. Now, you might be listening to all of this and think that I'm not doing a very good job of selling you on Christianity. And I guess that would indeed be the case. And if you've been following along in our study through Genesis, you may have also thought many of the same sort of thoughts, because we have just seen continual conflict and difficulty. And thinking, is this really representative of Christian faith? We've had lying and cheating and fear and multiple wives and concubines and endless relationship conflicts as we have been going through. Well, maybe by the end of the sermon, I hope I can shed some light on this, as we're now turning to see Jacob come limping home. So Genesis chapter 31, which we looked at the last time, gives us the account of Jacob's departure from Haran, which is where his mother's family was from, where Abraham's ancestral family was. And he had returned from, he's departing from there to the land of Canaan, back to the land that God had promised to Abraham and promised to Isaac and promised to Jacob. So Jacob had worked for 14 years for Leah and Rachel, and then he'd worked another 6 years for his own profit to build up his own estate under an agreement that he had made with Laban. And even though Laban sought to turn things to his advantage in the deal with Jacob, Jacob had actually succeeded, had actually prospered. He had profited greatly, as God obviously was blessing him despite Laban's attempts. So Jacob's prosperity actually heightened the conflict between Jacob and Laban and his family. And the Lord appeared to Jacob in a dream, confirming his promises to him once again and telling him to leave. It's time to leave. It's time to get back to the land of Canaan, which the Lord had promised to bring him back to. So Laban pursues after Jacob once he has departed with the intention of doing him harm. But the Lord also appeared to Laban in a dream and warned him not to do anything to Jacob, good or bad. Don't try to bring him back one way or the other by any means. So you might say that Jacob and Laban didn't exactly part the best of friends. But they did part with a covenant between them that neither would pursue the other to harm. Well, chapter 32 brings us to a greater problem for Jacob than Laban, actually, and that is his estranged brother Esau. So Jacob had one sort of problem that was behind him in the person of Laban and the conflict that he had with him. And now he's got another problem that is before him, and that is Esau. I mean, at least Laban just wanted to enrich himself and keep Jacob in slavery and from having any possessions. Esau wanted to kill him. So he's got one problem behind him and another problem in front of him. So Jacob has to meet with his brother to return to the land. He knows that this is how that it's going to have to be. And he's still afraid of Esau. He's still afraid of what he might do. He, even though it's been 20 years by this point, he was so angry and had sworn that he would kill Jacob after their father Isaac had passed away. So this chapter highlights for us the great wealth of Jacob. And you may not think about that. There's so many things that happen here in chapter 32. And we may not think about that, but there's evidence of that when you see that he takes a portion of all of his property and he offers it as a gift to Esau. And when you consider the nature of that gift, you realize he had to have substantial wealth by this time to be able to make such an offer just as a gift to his brother. Now, Jacob had grown wealthy as evidence of God's blessing on him, just as Abraham had, just as Isaac had. Now, the fact that God blessed Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and one of the tangible or visible means of that blessing was great wealth and great prosperity, that doesn't say anything to us today as to whether we will be rich or poor or somewhere in between. The point is, God's faithfulness to His Word and the assurance that God will prevail over all opposition, impossibilities, and difficulties to fulfill that Word. And so we see Abraham and Isaac and now Jacob, who has prospered and become wealthy, and Jacob's is probably in the most unlikely way, as he has been spending most of his time over the last 20 years being essentially an indentured servant. Well, this chapter also highlights once again the strength and the shrewdness of Jacob, even though he's about 97 years old at this time. But in the end, Jacob prevails, but not by strength. And he prevails not by cunning, but he prevails in weakness through faith. So this chapter has three main parts to it. Verses 1 to 12, where we see Jacob's prayer. Verses 13 to 21, where we see Jacob's present that he sent to Esau. And in verses 22 to 32, where we see Jacob's prevailing. So we want to begin looking at each of these sections. And we'll begin here with the first part of Jacob's prayer. And let's start again with verses 1 and 2. And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's host." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. So as Jacob was on the border of the promised land, about to enter that land, he was met by the angels of God. Now, obviously, this parallels the way that he left, because 20 years prior to this, he was leaving from the land of Canaan, and he's crossing this border to go into the lands beyond Canaan and ultimately to Haran. And he also, at that time, at Bethel, saw the angels of God. We read about that in back in chapter 28, verses 11 to 15. And in fact, I believe that's the only two places in the Bible where we have that specific phrase used, the angels of God. It's used here and it's used there. And so Jacob gives a name to this place as he sees these angels. He recognizes it. He calls it God's host or troop or encampment. It's language that is very military. The word that is used here for host, it has the idea of like a great army. So like an army encampment or something that he's referring to. And so he names this place Mahanaim, which means essentially two camps. And Jacob gave this name, indicating that he recognized God's encampment in this place along with his. Now, part of Jacob's story, as difficult as it has been up to this point, but a part of Jacob's story has been that God has always been with him. There's not always been some visible manifestation. There's not always been some dream where God spoke to him. There's not always been those things. But those things are just signs and tokens assuring Jacob that God has always been with him. And even as you track his unlikely course, and the fact that he's returning to the land of Canaan, and he's doing so with great wealth and great prosperity. When he left the land of Canaan 20 years prior, he left with nothing. He literally had the clothes on his back and the shoes on his feet and probably a staff in his hand. And that's all that he had leaving that land. And now he comes back with great wealth, the beginnings of a great nation. So God has always been with him. And so Jacob names this place two camps. There are two camps here. I'm camped with all of my household, with all of my servants, with all of my flocks and herds. I am camped here, but God is also camped here. God has his angels encamped here as well. Look at verses 3 to 8. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother unto the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, "Thus shall ye speak unto my lord Esau. Thy servant Jacob saith thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. And I have oxen and asses and flocks and men servants and women servants. And I have sent to tell my lord that I may find grace in thy sight." And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, We came to thy brother Esau, and also he cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him. Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that was with him, and the flocks and herds and the camels, into two bands, and said, If Esau come to the one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape. So Jacob now is within range, and he has sent out these messengers ahead of him to greet Esau, to inform him of Jacob's coming into the land, but also to seek Jacob's kindness. He said there that it might be that he receives grace from Esau. Now, in sending out these messengers, he sends them out to announce, on the one part, as his own wealth. And Jacob isn't doing this as a brag. You know, it's not like typical family reunions where sometimes the stories can get quite long about all of the things that we've accomplished since the time that we've seen each other. No, this isn't that sort of a reunion. It's not that sort. It's not a brag. What Jacob is doing is indicating to Esau that he didn't need to take anything of Esau. He doesn't come here to take anything from Esau, but that God has greatly blessed him. He has his own wealth. He has his own abundance. He has everything that he needs. And he in other words, he's signaling that he doesn't want any sort of a conflict with Esau or a continued conflict. And then the messengers return to Jacob, and they report that Esau is actually on his way to meet Jacob, and he's on his way with a large band of men, 400 of them. The implication being that this is sort of like you might think of it maybe as a militia, his servants, no doubt. But he's on his way to meet Jacob, and of course Jacob fears the worst, and he has good reason to. And so he splits his camp into two in order to provide some defense, so that if Esau does have ill intentions and he comes and attacks, that at least one camp will be able to get away. Then we come into verses 9 and 12, and where we see Jacob's prayer specifically. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord, which saidst unto me, Return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which thou hast shown unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. And thou saidst, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. So Jacob's prayer here, it is a prayer of faith. And we see that Jacob does a few things in this prayer as he speaks to God. First of all, he rehearses God's own words of promise and command that he gave Jacob. And we see this here in verse number 9. And when he refers to God as the God of my father Abraham and the God of my father Isaac, he is approaching God on the basis of his covenant promises to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob. He says, you have instructed me to return unto the land. And in other words, Jacob is acknowledging to God that he is in faith obeying the words of God. He is returning to the land as God had said, even though he is in great fear. And that brings us to the next in verse number 10, where he appeals to God on the basis of God's covenant promises, and he confesses to God his own unworthiness. Now, you notice that he uses these two terms. He speaks of God's mercies and of his truth. Mercy and truth. Now, we've been studying those words quite a bit as we've been going through our series in the Psalms. Mercies there comes from the Hebrew word chesed. Chesed is a word that is oftentimes associated with covenant, with God's covenant. It refers to his loyalty, to his love and his mercy and all of these things that are that are promised, that God has promised, that God will fulfill according to, for the sake of His own name, but also truth, and that is emet in the Hebrew, and especially when you see these two words together. When you see these two words used together, we've noticed it a number of times in the Psalms, and it appears here, it appears in other places in the Old Testament, and there's an equivalent in the New Testament, grace and truth, that we can see used as well. They are important covenant terms. They refer to God's word as being trustworthy. So God has made promises, and those promises are sure. And God is loyal to His promises. God is gracious as He has promised to be. God shows mercy as He has promised to do. Now, what that means is that Jacob's prayer is a prayer of faith, but it's also what we might call a covenantal prayer. And we've noticed that a number of times in the Psalms, that God's covenant promises form the basis for that prayer. So in other words, Jacob, in essence, in this prayer is saying, God, I'm asking You to do what You have promised to do. I'm asking You, I'm trusting Your faithfulness. I'm trusting Your covenant loyalty. And he says here, I'm not worthy of the least of God's covenant promises or His faithfulness. Jacob says, I'm not worthy of these. In other words, he's not trying to make some claim by which he can call God into his obligation. God, I have done this, so therefore You must do this. That is not at all what Jacob is saying. Jacob is saying, You have, in Your covenant and according to Your purpose, you've chosen me. You have shown grace to me. I'm not worthy to receive the promises of Your covenant. I'm not worthy for those promises to be fulfilled in me. And then we see that he goes into verse 11, praying, and he confesses his own fears. Just the prayer of honesty with God. Lord, deliver me, I pray Thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. And Jacob here, of course, shows his own weakness. He shows his own imperfection of faith. God, I know what You've promised. I know what You've commanded me to do. But I'm also afraid for my life, and I am afraid for the life of my family. And so this is the prayer that Jacob is making. And ultimately, as he concludes it in verse number 12, we see him resting firmly in God's promises. In other words, he's not going to turn around and run. He's going to go forward, but he's going to go forward not because he's so brave and courageous, not because he's so sure of himself. He's going to go forward because of God's promises. He says, and Thou saidst, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. And then, of course, referring back to God appearing to him and speaking to him back in chapter 28 when he was in Bethel. And God promised, I'll be with you and I will bring you back to this land. So his prayer rests on God's promises, not his worthiness, not his strength, not his cunning, but on God's promises and God's faithfulness to his promises. All the while he confesses he's not worthy of that. He's not worthy of God showing him mercy according to covenant pride. He's not worthy of that. He's not worthy of being included in that. He's weak, but yet he is trusting the Lord. Then we come to the second part of the chapter, and that's the present that Jacob sends to Esau. This is in verses 13 to 21. And he lodged there that same night and took of that which came to his hand, a present for Esau his brother, 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milch camels with their colts, 40 kine and 10 bulls, 20 she-asses and 10 foals. And he delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by themselves, and said unto his servants, pass over before me, and put a space betwixt drove and drove. And he commanded the foremost, saying, when Esau my brother meeteth thee, and asketh thee, saying, whose art thou, and whither goest thou, and whose are these before thee? Then thou shalt say, they be thy servant Jacob's. It is a present sent unto my lord Esau. And behold, also he is behind us. And so commanded he the second and third and all that followed the drove, saying, On this manner shall you speak unto Esau when you find him. And say ye moreover, Behold, thy servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goeth before me. And afterward I will see his face. Peradventure he will accept of me. So went the present over before him, and himself lodged that night in the company. So Jacob then thought to send these gifts to his brother Esau. And again, this shows an evidence of the great wealth of Jacob. When you add this up, he sent over 500 animals to Esau as a gift. And not just any animals, but valuable animals that he sends to his brother as a gift. And this is just a part that he's taken out of his own wealth to send to his brother. So Jacob also backs up the words that he had sent by his messengers ahead of time. And he also seeks to appease Esau, to hope to relieve any wrath that he may have retained against Jacob. In other words, Jacob wants to reconcile with his brother. He wants to for there to be no conflict between them. And so he determines to send these gifts in droves ahead of him and the company that's going to come behind. And then that brings us to the last part where Jacob prevails. And here in we'll start with verses 22 and 23. And he rose up that night and took his two wives and his two women servants and his 11 sons and passed over the ford Jabbok. And he took them and sent them over the brook and sent over that he had. So Jacob is now preparing to meet Esau the next day. And he sends his immediate family over the ford, and he remains alone, totally alone by himself on the other side. And we're not told why that Jacob did this, and there doesn't seem to be any that he was given any sort of a sign or told to do this in any way. Perhaps he was going to pray again, or we just don't know exactly why he did this, but he did do this, and so he's left alone. That's the point that is made as we proceed, verses 24 and 25. And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. So mysteriously, we're told that a man appears, and this man appears and wrestles with Jacob. And the word for wrestle, I mean, it means to grapple, to grapple in a physical contest. So just what we think of when we use the word wrestling, not in any sort of figurative or metaphorical sense. It's just there's a physical contest that is taking place between Jacob and this man that has appeared when Jacob is left alone. And we're also told that apparently the match lasted all night. Now, the word for prevail that is used, and it will be used again in a few verses, the word for prevail that is used, it means to overcome. And that the man did not prevail over Jacob indicates that Jacob would not willingly yield. Now, that is also evident as the account continues as well. In other words, it doesn't mean that Jacob prevailed over him or that Jacob defeated him in the wrestling match. Jacob just simply wouldn't quit. He would not yield. And so this goes on for however long that it has gone on. And he will not yield. So the man did not prevail over him in that way. And then with a touch, with simply a touch, he puts Jacob's thigh or hip out of joint. And the words that are used to describe what this injury, what happened to Jacob here, as I understood it, as I researched into it somewhat, the words that are used here are very obscure and very, very rare words. They're very ancient words in Hebrew. And so what that means is that we can't really describe what happened with any sort of certainty in medical terms. But the result was that he walked with a limp due to this physical injury. Now let's continue. Verses 26 to 28. And he said, this was the man, let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me. And that was Jacob's response. And he said unto him, the man speaking again, what is thy name? And he said, Jacob, Jacob responding. And he said, this is the man again, thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel, for as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. So the man commands Jacob to release him because of the coming dawn. So obviously, Jacob has continued clinging to him, even though he was physically weakened by this injury. But Jacob still would not yield. Again, he's just continuing to cling. He will not quit. Now, the name of Jacob, which means something like hill catcher or like a tripper or a supplanter or something along that line. And that name of Jacob, it has already been commented that he was well named Jacob because it's actually described his character and his actions that we have seen thus far. But now this man gives him a new name, the name of Israel, which means something like prevailing with God or wrestling with God, something along that line. And so Jacob has prevailed, is stated there at the end of verse number 28. And the point is that Jacob prevailed not by strength. He didn't prevail by cunning, though he definitely had both of those things and has proven that throughout his life. But the point is rather that he prevailed through faith that caused him to cling even when he was beaten in order to receive a blessing. In the last of the chapter, beginning in verse 29, and Jacob asked him and said, tell me, I pray thee, thy name. And he said, wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name? And he blessed him there. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. And as he passed over Peniel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. Therefore the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh, unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh and the sinew that shrank. So Jacob then asks this man's name, and the response is curious. Why are you asking my name? In other words, this response amounts to him saying, don't you know who I am? Why are you asking my name? Don't you know who I am? And Jacob realized, as we read on, that he had seen God. I've seen God face to face. And in fact, Hosea comments on this in Hosea chapter 12 and verse number 4, also commenting that Jacob had seen God. So obviously this man that had wrestled, and the word for man there indicating that he appeared as a human man, and this is an appearance of Christ in human form, pre-incarnate that we refer to, like he appeared to Abraham in Genesis chapter number 18. And Jacob names the place of the encounter, Peniel, which means something like the face of God. And Moses referred at the end of this chapter, it refers to the tradition of not eating part of the hindquarters of animals because of Jacob's hip. And again, it's not entirely clear exactly what is it that's not being eaten here. One thing that's interesting is that this is not recorded anywhere in the law. This was never a commandment that was actually given by God to Israel, but it did persist in traditional Judaism. So now we come to the end of this chapter, and we come back to our question about all these difficulties. And what do all these difficulties of life say about Christianity? Well, we read a chapter like this, and we think about all the things that have contributed and all the difficulties that Jacob has faced, and some of those have been of his own doing, some of those have not been of his own doing. But nevertheless, it causes us to think all the way back to Genesis chapter 3, verses 15 to 19, where God speaking to Adam and Eve said, and I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed. It shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. And unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground. For out of it thou wast taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. So we see in these curses that for Adam and Eve, every relationship that they would have has now been affected by sin and has now been made more difficult because of sin, whether it's their relationship to one another as husband and wife, whether it's their relationship to one another as just fellow human beings or family members, whether it's their relationship to the natural creation and order around them, and on and on and on. All of these things are now just fraught with conflict, fraught with difficulty, and Genesis has told us that every page since then. That's the story that we have read, and it is because of living on a sin-cursed earth. And it certainly is seen in the conflict between Jacob and Esau. And actually, when we think about Jacob's life, all of Jacob's relationships are fraught with conflicts. And again, you can look at it, you can trace it out that a number of those things are his fault. And other things are not necessarily his fault, but again, he's fraught with conflict on every side. Well, the Bible is the story of redemption, and the failures of the faith heroes, such as Jacob, show the impossibility of self-redemption. So yes, we see weakness in Jacob, we see weakness in Isaac, we see weakness in Abraham. We will go on to see weakness in Moses if we keep on reading, and on and on and on down the line, and David, the great king of Israel. We will see weakness and sin in all of them. There is no self-redemption. The promise in Genesis 3:15 was that God was going to send a seed. He was going to send a son, a man born of a woman that was going to restore this earth and redeem mankind. And so since then, we are tracking that promised seed, and so far he hasn't come. And how do we know that he hasn't come? Because none of them have accomplished that. And they won't. So when we read a chapter like this and we think about all these failings and all these difficulties and all these struggles, well, it also highlights for us God's grace. We don't deserve redemption. I mean, you go through Genesis and you go from Genesis 3 and you go up to Genesis 6 and 7 and you get up there to the flood, and God destroys all living things from off the face of the earth because of sin, because of corruption. And what happens immediately afterward? Well, sin and corruption and conflict. And it's just an ongoing story. And it will continue to go on that way, of course, until the Lord returns. So we don't deserve redemption. And Jacob acknowledges that in this chapter as he's praying to God. You set your love on me while I was yet in the womb with my brother. And I don't deserve that. So the message of the Bible is not that Christians deserve redemption. That's not the message of the Bible. The message of the Bible is that none of us deserve redemption. But God has mercy. And God redeems those who humble themselves in repentance and have faith in Him. So the lesson is that we must trust God's Word. And that really is the faith of Jacob that we see even in this chapter. That was the real foundation. That's why Jacob was continuing to move forward. He was literally scared for his life in the face of his brother Esau, but yet he was moving forward. Why? Because he was trusting God's word. God has spoken and revealed what he will do, and no opposition or impossibility will prevent him from fulfilling it. So Israel on the plains of Moab, before they are to enter into the promised land that Moses is writing this to, they will prevail like Jacob by clinging to the Lord in faith, not by having the superior army. And that is the same lesson for us today as well.